This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's R-E-B-A-G.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi, this is Jane Garvey. It's the Woman's Hour podcast. It's Friday, the 27th of November, 2020. Hello, good morning. Welcome to the programme. Princess Diana, Diana Princess of Wales, Lady Di, she has been discovered all over again, this time by the Netflix generation. We'll talk about that on the programme this morning. What it's like to reach the age at which your mother died. We're going to start a series of very thought-provoking conversations with women about their experience of exactly that, and some great emails from you already on that subject. If you would like to get involved, you can email the programme via our website, of course. Yesterday, we talked to the NUS President Larissa Kennedy. Today you can hear from the Universities Minister, Michelle Donnellan. That will be of particular interest to you if your child has perhaps endured their first term at university. What has that been like for you? How are they getting home? What about testing? Let us know how that experience has been at BBC Women's Hour on social media. You can also text us on 84844. 84844 is the text number. And we'll also discuss a debut novel set in a hostel for the homeless in Dover. The author is Jessica Rinn, and the book is called The Extraordinary Hope of Dawn Brightside. That's later. Let's start with Princess Diana and the fourth series of The Crown, which has introduced that whole new generation to the princess, to her struggles, particularly with bulimia. Jenny Bond is the BBC's redoubtable former royal correspondent. Jenny, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And we're joined too by Ali Pantani, 28, and somebody who writes for Glamour magazine, amongst others. Ali, welcome. Tell us, first of all, how much you knew about Diana before this series of The Crown.
Hi there. Well, I think myself and my generation didn't know an awful lot about Diana. You know, I think we knew the basics, but we... And I think a lot of us actually remember when she died, but her actual story and her life before that, I personally didn't know a lot about it. So the new series of The Crown has really opened up my eyes to her story and everything that she went through.
So The Crown has, what, filled in the gaps for you?
Yes, I'd say so. Yeah, yeah, quite realistically, I hear.
Right. Well, we'll find out about that in a minute. I just wonder which particular aspects of the way her story is covered in The Crown has really struck you.
Well, it's definitely her eating disorder, her battle with bulimia, which, you know, the show prefaced with a trigger warning. So, you know, it's going to be quite quite graphic. But it's certainly the most realistic portrayal of that I've seen on TV. And I had no idea that that's the extent to which she went through that.
And you, I know, have been through it yourself. Mm-hmm. You believe it is effective, the way it's dealt with in this series of The Crown?
Yeah, I think it's the most accurate portrayal I've seen of bulimia on TV. And I'm grateful that they haven't shied away from it. You know, when we usually see bulimia in TV or film, it's glossed over. You know, the camera cuts away. You hear someone retching. The toilet flushes. 2 seconds later, an actress emerges. And then it's like nothing happened. So, you know, that kind of representation kind of downplays this illness. It does nothing to destigmatize it, especially something that is still so shrouded in misconception and stigma. You know, to downplay it like that doesn't help people understand it. So, you know, in The Crown, we witness Diana's you know, binge purge cycle in quite a lot of graphic detail. And, you know, the way it becomes her coping mechanism during, you know, upsetting and triggering times for her. So, it, you know, it can be difficult to watch, especially as someone that's been through it. And also for people that, you know, have no idea what it's like. It's upsetting to watch, but it should be.
Yes.
Because, you know, this is real and it's happening to people
well,
all the time.
If it leads to greater understanding, then that's a win, isn't it? That's good.
Exactly.
Jenny, obviously, I know you knew Diana. You spent time, just the two of you, I gather, chatting. Did you know about her bulimia?
Oh, yes. By the time I had those long sessions with her at Kensington Palace, it was very well known. I mean, you have to remember, maybe in the next series of The Crown, we'll get to it. In 1993, she made a speech in which she didn't speak, she didn't admit it, she was talking about herself, but she said, I have it on very good authority. The quest for perfection in our society demands, those demands can leave individuals gasping for breath. And she spoke about the self-revulsion and the low personal esteem that can lead to someone wanting to dissolve like a disprin. Well, we all knew she was talking about herself. So by the time I had a long chat with her in 1995, a couple of years later,
yeah.
I asked her about it and she said she now had it under control, but it had plagued her for probably a decade.
Yes, just listening there to you recount that speech she made back in 1993, that is a very 21st century speech, isn't it? When you listen to those words, that's a speech that could be made now in the social media age.
Yeah. I mean, she said bulimia was a shameful friend and a refuge from having to face more painful issues at the centre of our lives. I mean, Freddie Flintoff did a brilliant documentary
yes.
quite recently about his battle with it. So it is ongoing. But I think Ali's right that there still is a stigma about it. And this is the first graphic portrayal, I think, of someone retching down the toilet bowl that I think there's been.
But do you understand, Jenny, why women, young women like Ali have fastened on to Diana for, I suppose, for precisely the reason I've just outlined, that some of the things she was saying back in the 90s are things that are being said today. And sometimes people think they're saying them for the first time. But Diana was living this and saying this decades ago.
She was, yes. And, you know, you and I lived through those years and reported on them. And so it was really odd to suddenly discover a few years ago that when I said Diana, instead of everyone knowing exactly who I was talking about,
yeah.
they'd say who, you know, who. Even my own daughter, who's 30, actually paid very little attention to Diana through all those years. And I think this series has sparked a new interest. And it's really important, I think, that they understand the woman she was. But I would also say that every character, I think, in The Crown has quite understandably been exaggerated. There is artistic license used by Peter Morgan. And of course, there would be. I mean, I don't think the royal family were half as cruel as they made out. Charles was not such a demon as portrayed. And I don't think Diana was as strong as she's portrayed in her early years, at least. She grew to be strong, but I'm not sure she would have stood up to the courtiers in quite the way we see in those early episodes.
So we know there are trigger warnings about the show's depiction of bulimia. Do you think, Jenny, you could justify some sort of announcement saying parts of this drama are completely fictionalised? Please understand that when you watch.
Well, I think that would be helpful because reading social media, as I have over the last few days, you know, people are being vindictive about Charles and Camilla. And I think it's really important that young people remember that, yes, this is broadly a reflection of what happened in this very unhappy marriage. But it is a drama. This is not a documentary. So just important to remember that, I think.
Ali, do you think, honestly, talking to your peers, that everybody does get that?
I think so. I think, you know, I think people realise that it is a drama. And of course, Diana is not here to, you know, guide the producers and tell them exactly what happened. So especially with her. But I think people are aware that it's, you know, it's a TV show. It needs to attract an audience. And, you know, I think it's very easy, especially with the portrayal of Charles and Camilla in terms of what Diana went through, it's quite easy to sit there and be angry at them and think, God, what an awful way to treat such a young woman. But I think you do always have to remind yourself, you know, I'm sure they didn't say those exact words. You know, it's not, it's as we say, it's not a documentary.
Well, has it actually started an interest in the royal family that perhaps just was largely absent, or perhaps was sparked again by the arrival of Meghan Markle, who, of course, has now departed these shores? But tell me about that, Ali.
I think so. I think I personally didn't know an awful lot about the royal family
or care
before The Crown. Yeah, I think so. I think Diana was always the one I kind of cared about a bit more, just from knowing, as I said, basics about her story. But yeah, the royal family in general, just I don't speak for everyone. It's just my experience, but it was just something that never really interested me. You know, it wasn't you know, sort of abolish the monarchy, but it wasn't, you know, hanging on their every word and wanting to learn about it. But since The Crown, and particularly since this season, it's been something that I've certainly got more interested in.
How much, though, has really been learnt, Jenny, when you think about what the Duchess of Sussex has said this week about her miscarriage? And she's written a very moving article about it. And yes, she's had sympathy and support, but again, she's had criticism and there's been vitriol. Have we really moved on?
Well, I'm afraid social media has a large part to play. The vitriol that is spouted against Meghan Markle and against the Cambridges, the war now we have between the Cambridges and Sussex's supporters and fans, is hideous. I mean, if I say anything about the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan, you know, I've been called a white racist whore for just suggesting the mildest criticism. It's very unpleasant, the social media response to Meghan. But I do think that we have there a young woman who found it equally, as Fergie did, as Diana did, very difficult, as Prince Philip did, very difficult to fit into this rather strange and straight-laced family.
Yeah. When you think about Diana's journey, Ali, this idea, are your peers actually thinking of her as someone who was, I don't know, sacrificed, almost plucked from obscurity because she was untainted and given a role to which she wasn't suited, and with a man who loved somebody else? I mean, when you actually say those words, it was clearly not going to work, was it?
Exactly. And I think that's, you know, all those things, you know, being under so much pressure to transform into somebody that she wasn't, betrothed to a man she barely knew. And then, as I believe she herself said, trapped in a very unhappy marriage, like you say, with a man that was clearly in love with somebody else. It really is no wonder that she developed bulimia, because, you know, when your life is spiraling so out of your control and you have no control over anything, bulimia and other eating disorders give you that semblance of control. So, you know, it's really no wonder when you think of everything that she was going through. And she was 19. It's so young.
Yes.
To have all that immense pressure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm 17 or 16 when the engagement was announced. And I do remember watching it on the telly. And even I was a complete moron, I realised that Diana was incredibly young to be in that position. So really, really quickly, Ali, has this, I alluded to it earlier, has it led to a wider understanding of bulimia, do you think, honestly?
I think so. I think that's why we're very grateful to Netflix and to The Crown for what they've done. I think we have a long way to go. I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. But, you know, the more we have these honest depictions, these frank conversations, the more we can abolish the secrecy that bulimia and other eating disorders thrive in. So the more we talk about this, and The Crown has started the conversation, the more people will get the help they need.
Let's hope so. That will be something, won't it? Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Ali Pantani, who works for Glamour magazine. You also heard from Jenny Bond, the former BBC royal correspondent. Any thoughts on that? Perhaps you're someone who is watching The Crown. Perhaps you've never seen it and you don't like the sound of it at all. At BBC Woman's Out on social media, or you can email us via the website. Now, around this time yesterday, Larissa Kennedy was on the programme, president of the NUS. And today we're going to talk to the Universities Minister and Conservative MP for Chippenham, Michelle Donnellan. Michelle, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. I'm OK. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks. Now, this is about the testing, the idea that you can get more than 1 million university students safely back home to their families for Christmas. Tell us how it's going to work. This is the on-campus mass testing. It's being rolled out across the entire university and higher education system next week, is it?
So testing is only one element of our plan to get students home for Christmas. In fact, it complements it fundamentally. But the main point is that we've created a student travel window from the 3rd to the 9th of December. So that's directly after national restrictions end, which means that the risk that students would then pose by traveling, that mass movement, would be vastly reduced. And we've staggered it across the days, working with the Department of Transport, working with university sectors, and they've staggered it internally.
Yeah.
And then testing complements that, and it's targeted at the most at risk areas, so those that have had higher R rates, universities that have had higher outbreak rates, and those with a higher percentage of students that are vulnerable as well.
Right, OK. And now, what does the student actually have to do? First of all, this is voluntary. But if you do want to have a test, what's on the student to actually do here?
Yeah, so if your university is offering a test, then I would urge every student who's listening to take that up. It just offers you that extra peace of mind going home when you're seeing your loved ones and you've seen your family, but you've had that negative result and that you're not going to pose a risk. And many students will be spending Christmas with elderly or vulnerable relatives. So it's really important to give them a sense of comfort and also their relatives.
Of course, Michelle, we don't have a lot of time, and I think absolutely people will get that. But in practical terms, first of all, you've got to register online, I think, at many institutions. And then you have to have one test. Then you have to come back for another test 3 days later.
So universities will be providing all the information to their students. A number of universities will be offering the two tests. Some universities will just be offering one test. So it's important that you check exactly what your university is doing, where you have to go, where it will be done. But all that information will be very clear. And we're working with universities to ensure that they've given students all the information that they need to access.
OK. I mean, obviously, listeners are asking questions. Here's one from Robert. Could you ask the minister to confirm whether all universities are required to offer tests? We understand that, for example, Plymouth is not. Well, why not?
So we offered all universities the opportunity to do this. Not every university is going to make good on that, but we will be announcing next week what we're planning to do in terms of January. However, we have targeted our support to make sure that those universities that had higher outbreak rates, that have the highest percentage of vulnerable students, or that are in areas which have had higher R rates, do offer those tests to students.
Right. I mean, as I said, this is voluntary. So what percentage do you think will take it up at all?
Well, I believe a very high percentage of students will do. It's a really to offer them that extra comfort. We're doing it for them. And we've seen throughout the last few months that the vast majority of students have done exactly as we've asked of them. They've abided by the rules, abided by the regulations, and tried to protect their friends and their communities.
But if they find out they're positive, then what do they do?
Well, they will have to isolate like you or I would if we found out we are positive. That's a legal requirement.
But they could be asymptomatic. And I wonder whether the temptation, if you were a student, would be simply not to have the test at all.
Absolutely, I disagree, because I have every faith in students that they won't want to go back and put their grandparents or their parents or their carers at risk. This is all about giving them that comfort to protect their families and their loved ones. It's the biggest incentive ever to get a test. And we're working with universities to ensure that if they do have to self-isolate, they'll have that support in terms of welfare and well-being and mental health and access to food and other things to make sure that they're looked after during that period.
And what about coming back in January? How will that work?
So we're planning to announce on that shortly to give clarity to both students, staff, parents. And I understand that there is an eagerness to get that information as soon as possible. And I'm hoping to be able to do that in the coming days.
And what about if people are asking if teaching doesn't end or hasn't ended on the 9th of December? What do you do then?
So we worked with the sector to ensure it does in terms of face-to-face teaching. After that period, it will go online.
So what, for any, even the scientific courses? Because a number of listeners are asking about lab work. They feel that their student offspring have not been able to get access to labs. What about that?
Yeah, so the reason why we picked the 9th, it isn't some arbitrary date. It is a period of time in which students remain lower risk because it's close to national restrictions. Also, it means that should a student then get traced after the 9th, well, then that we can't guarantee that they'll be home for Christmas in time. So if they leave before the 9th, or if they are traced within that window, they've still got time to then isolate. And those students that were doing practical courses, they will still end on the 9th. We've worked with the sector to be able to ensure that that happens. If there are students that choose to stay because, say, they have a part-time job or they They want to stay in their local community. There's no legal requirement for them to leave by the night. But what we're saying is that you then run the risk of potentially having to isolate over Christmas.
Right. OK. I just wonder whether for that very reason, that will mean that students might be, in some cases, reluctant to have these tests, even if they are available. And as you've outlined, they aren't available everywhere. This is an email from a listener who says, "My daughter's first term has been memorable for all the wrong reasons. She arrived in mid-September, got COVID, along with most of her halls of residence, ran out of food, and has had the most socially isolating experience since then. She spends 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, in a 2x4 metre room. All but two of her flatmates have given up and gone home. All her lessons are online." I mean, this, I don't think that's uncommon, Michelle, and this it must be unbearable for some students, perhaps a minority. This whole first term has just been insufferable.
I completely agree that it has been a really difficult and challenging term for students, and it's not the term that we would have wanted for them, and not the term that they would have wanted if we're brutally honest. And this is all because of the ramifications of COVID. As a government, we prioritised education to ensure that those students didn't have to put their lives and their academic journeys on hold, which I believe would be far worse. We've worked with the universities to ensure that the support is there for those students and that they should be getting in the main, a blended offer, so in person and online. We've got hope now for the next term. So the utilisation of mass testing, the Prime Minister spoke this week about technology coming on stream, potentially around test and release, which offers greater opportunities. We know that the vaccine is offering hope for the next year. So hopefully students will take comfort in that. But our priority has always been education throughout this and making sure they didn't have to put their lives on hold. But further to your point before around not believing that students will take these tests, really think it's important that we have faith in students. I do. I think that they will recognise the value of these tests, and you know, students will understand how important it is to access that test if available.
Now, yesterday we were talking to Larissa Kennedy, who is the NUS president, and the subject of student mental health came up, not surprisingly. How can the answer be £3 million on Student Space, another online platform, £9 million on mental health charities and more money for the next academic year, asks this emailer. Can you ask Michelle whether she acknowledges that the best way to address this crisis is to stop the harms which are causing it? If students didn't have to spend 23 hours a day in their shoebox rooms, many of them would not now be in need of this extra online support. I mean, I know you're going to say that obviously this isn't the term that anybody wanted, but can we just discuss the high cost of rent for student halls and, in many cases, the relatively poor accommodation provided? What do you say about that?
So accommodation is obviously done privately, either by landlords or by universities, and we've worked closely with them to ensure that all the support is there and available. And the offer should, in the main, be blended, so in person and online. There will be some students that have had to self-isolate over the last term because they've been picked up on the trace or because they've had COVID themselves. And in that case, and we've ensured that they have the support available. But on the whole, it should be a blended offer. We've all just been through a period of national restrictions where we can't do the things that we'd want to do. And now we'll be navigating out of that onto a tiered system again next week. Look, this has been very challenging for students. Nobody for one minute is denying that. But we have to remember what's caused all of these things, and it is COVID. And our priority has to be to keep the public safe and to keep students safe and staff. So there was no way we could have, say, allowed students to be omitted from having to self-isolate if they had the virus or if they were picked up on trace. So it has been really tough for students.
Okay.
And I'm working to ensure it's easier next term.
Right. OK, thank you very much. I know many people will have a view on that. I'm sorry we don't have more time. That was the university's minister, Michelle Donnellan. Now, this is something that has really got a very interesting reaction from many of you already via email, so thank you for that. How does it feel to get to the age your mum was when she died? In a new series, our reporter Jo Morris is going to be talking to four women with different stories, but who are all the same, but who all feel that the age their mother died has really had an impact on the way they live their own life. First, you can hear from Rachel. She lives in Devon with her family. Even people who know Rachel really well don't know about a feeling that she's been keeping secret.
My mum died very suddenly. She had a stroke. My mum died very soon after her 40th birthday. So it was like 2 weeks later. So there was a big sort of celebration of this special age. And I can remember when we went to see relatives after she died, you know, people sort of making more of that, sort of saying, oh, you know, 40 is supposed to be where life begins sort of thing. So that age is really, really stuck. It's been really significant. It's just felt like a bit of a deadline, really. I've never talked about it, and therefore, because I haven't talked about it, I assumed it wasn't an issue for anyone else. I've never heard this mentioned before. And I thought it was just me being a bit neurotic, really. Somewhere along the way, in losing my mum at the age of 40, that decision in my head was like, right, that's my timeline then. That's what I'm working towards. I never expected to make it to 40. I shouldn't laugh at the end of that.
Why are you laughing?
I don't know.
Why are you laughing?
Because it does sound bonkers. It does sound bonkers.
And how old are you now?
I'm 40 now.
You've just reached the same age.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of comparison going on between what I'm doing now and how she may have felt when she was that age. Because as a child, you don't think of your mother and what she goes through. You just think of her as a mum.
Just, where's my dinner?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, there's a lot now of sort of just, you know, that empathy of where she would have been in her life. And
so how have you been feeling?
Very reflective, I suppose, about being a mum and bringing up a family, and prioritising a family. There's just a bit of paranoia, really, that things could just end very suddenly. I could tell my husband was worried about it. My dad's mentioned it before.
What have they both said?
My dad was like, oh, I'd be really pleased once you get past 40. I was like, oh, thanks, Dad. You know?
So when did he say that to you?
I don't know. He said it on a couple of occasions.
When you were young, or?
No, sort of 30s. And my husband's heard it, and he's like, oh, you know, that's worried him. And I was 12 years old, and then suddenly she's just gone. Life is just completely flipped on its head. Nothing is what you thought it was going to be, and nothing is... All the parameters are taken away, and personally, I just felt very much on my own. You know, that's no sort of disrespect to the rest of my family. It was my approach of sort of dealing with it, was to just be very independent and just to get on. There's that sort of instinctiveness there and survival, but somewhere along the way it was... Yeah, I'm going to get on with life, and I know that life is going to finish just as my mum's life finished, and that makes perfect sense in my head.
What was your mum like?
Her name was Angela. She was creative. She would make our clothes, sewing, knitting. She was working part-time, so I'm the youngest of four, and I was 12. So, you know, all the children were probably off to school and a bit more independent. I think it was just giving her a bit more time just to focus on some things that she liked to do. She's a really good cook, always cooked amazing dinners and roast dinners. You know, that was a huge part of our family, was to all eat together. And I don't have many pictures of my mum around. I don't really have family pictures up. This was a typical after dinner shot. My mum's probably thinking, oh, I just would like to relax for 2 seconds, and I've got my arms all around her, which is very much what my children do to me now. And I'm just like, okay, can I just have 5 minutes?
The old, like, they pretend they're giving you a massage, yes. But it's a sort of intense squeeze.
Exactly, yeah. So she's trying to relax with what looks like a cup of coffee and a Bailey's on the side, and the ashtray is there as well. Taken quite a while ago before we decorated, so the lovely old curtains. So this is back in our family home. That was just life, you know, that was just... I don't think I'm good at looking at photos, because it's kind of like, you didn't know what was going to happen then, you didn't know what was coming, so that's quite sad in a way as well. She's not done her hair. Life is busy, bringing up 4 kids and a dog and the house, and there's something very special about life just being ordinary and no big dramas, the security of just having your family around, and that's what I really love for my children now, and I suppose that's what I fear most for my children now, is that their world will be rocked in some way.
It's a very strong feeling that you've had continually over the years.
Yeah, but not consciously.
Yeah. Can you remember when you first had that particular feeling?
When I was waiting for the ambulance to arrive, when my mum died, that's a really vivid memory. And I think it was in that time that I decided this was it for me. I had this sort of thought in my head of being older and chatting to someone and saying, oh yeah, my mum died when she was 14. She wasn't dead at this point. We just found her at home, but she wasn't actually dead. And I think that was me sort of deciding then that
that was how life was going to be, and that was how life was going to be for me. It's really odd. You know, I had my first son when I was 35. Deep down, you can't sort of shift that ticking. Time is not on your side and time's running out. The amazing thing in that is that you see the absolute beauty in life and the world. You know, sort of moving to Devon was part of that, just wanting to celebrate everything that is fantastic in the world and in the environment and in nature. You almost feel that intensely because you feel it's going to be taken away. So it's a good feeling, but it's very closely followed by a fear, really, you know, being frightened.
No.
Shush.
Where's your shoes?
So after your mum died, did you talk about it at all in the family?
Not really, no. I just remember going to the hospital and my grandparents arriving. That was my mum's parents, and just bursting into tears. I just remember crying as soon as I saw them. And I think that was the moment where, I don't know if it was directly said, but it was kind of like, hold yourself together. You know, not in an aggressive way or in a bad way, but it's like, you know, take a deep breath. And I don't think I've sort of stopped holding it in since then, really. Friends who have lost people recently, it's so lovely and joyous to talk about their memories, and it's such a positive way to be. But it's kind of like, how do I bring my mum into conversations with people now, you know? And it's not a natural thing to do. And if I do, then I do just find it very emotional. So I tend to just sort of bat that away, really.
So what's this here? What have you got here?
Ah, this is my very subtle cardigan that my mum knitted. Which, now you've got to bear in mind that I was probably about 10 and this would fit me now, I think.
I love that. Bright pink mohair.
Yeah, with some highly contrasting roses on. And I think when I was at university, I probably wore it then. It's just a very special thing that I like to have. And I don't hold on to much to do with my mum, but it might have been one of the last things she knitted.
Does it smell of anything?
It's just got a slight must to it. Despite being kept nicely kept under the bed in a box, it's still got that nice.
Do you remember her making it for you?
I remember she was incredible at watching television and knitting at the same time and not dropping a stitch.
If you need to remember your mum, are there certain things you do?
A bit of Barbra Streisand, always, yeah.
Do you? Did she love Barbra Streisand?
Yeah.
A particular Barbra Streisand song?
Guilty, probably.
Can you remember her for this?
Yeah, honestly, it is just her. I don't know. I think it's a combination of just that time, the 70s dresses and, yeah, the 80s perms. You know, it's all very much Babs. Yeah. I always remember her doing the housework with headphones on. She had a Walkman.
So was it a surprise when you made it to your 40th birthday then, Rachel?
It was, yeah, it was. And it was a really odd thing to actually think, oh, I better do something. And I was so quiet about telling people I was going to be 40. Didn't feel like having a big party. I think there was still a bit of a like, oh, I don't know, this could all go terribly wrong at the last minute.
So what did you do on your 40th birthday?
We went out for lunch, my two brothers and sister, my dad. So it was understated, but it was special.
Did you tell them how you were feeling?
No, no. It's only since thinking about talking today, I mentioned it to my sister that I was doing it. And yeah, bizarrely now, however many years on, she was saying the same thing. I reached 40, I didn't die, and that's when I really started to see myself as me and think, wait a minute, I'm not my mum. I'm not my mum. And that, you know, actually saying that, so I'm not my mum, and thinking, why have I never said that to myself before? That is actually quite freeing and exciting. It's not a scary feeling. Dare I look to, you know, being 41, 42, 43, and... But I'm quite excited by the fact that there is no roadmap. I think it's a very freeing feeling.
Has it made you feel less lonely, reaching out?
Yeah, it has. It has. I've sent messages to friends who have lost their mum, and I opened up a conversation with them about it. And again, being completely surprised that they've had similar feelings. It really does feel like being back in the world again. It feels like there's nothing bad that can come out of talking about it more. It's not going to be an easy conversation to have with my family, and to actually pick up the phone and say, you know, hey, should we have a chat? It's going to be huge. I love it. I love a bit of Babs.
A bit of Babsy.
Yeah, she is my connection.
The power of Barbara Streisand. That was Rachel talking to our reporter, Jo Morris, about reaching the age at which her mum had died. Next week, another story, this time from Titiana. How have the deaths of her mother and her grandmother shaped the way that she sees her own life? And you can keep your emails on this subject coming. Some really nice ones. Thank you very much. You can do it via the website, bbc.co.uk/womanshour. Now to a debut novel by Jessica Rinn. The book is called The Extraordinary Hope of Dawn Brightside. And Jessica joins us live from her home. Jessica, hello. Good morning. How are you?
Hello, I'm good, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Great pleasure. Now, this is an unusual book for any number of reasons. First of all, the setting is a hostel for the homeless in Dover. Now,
that's right.
Why that as a location?
I've worked in hostels for several years as a support and resettlement worker in Dover one time as well. And I was just so inspired by the residents and watching people turn their lives around. And I wanted to give homeless people a bigger voice in fiction. So you often hear kind of sort of sad stories or even sort of scary stories sometimes. And I wanted to write something uplifting so that it could bring some hope to people.
Yes. Now, I imagine, I mean, people hear that it's possible for any of us to become homeless. What is it? You need three bits of consecutive bad luck.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's so easy for it to befall anybody. And that's something that I really wanted to hit home, just to stop people from always being so judgmental and just knowing that there's always more to the story.
Yes, I think that's a really good point, and I'm really glad you're making it in the book. Can you do a reading for us? Just set this one up for us, because your central character is called Dawn. Now, what do we need to know about Dawn?
Yeah, so Dawn is homeless and she's running from the secrets of her past. She's offered a bed in a homeless hostel, which is then threatened with closure due to funding cuts. Which is something that really commonly happens. Dawn and her fellow residents band together because they want to try and save it. And Dawn has to stop her past from catching up with her.
Right, on you go then.
Okay. One by one, each face in the room drains of colour. Dawn's face must look the same. 4 months is so soon. If the hostel closes, what will Dawn do then? Who will be left for her to look after? St Jude's is just so much more than just a roof over their heads. No. The word falls out of Dawn's mouth before she even knows it's in there. Every face is pointing towards her as something stirs deep inside her belly. We can't give up in this place. I won't. There's 16 of us who live here as well as staff. Am I right? You read about it all the time and there are definitely films about it. You know, when people band together to raise money for a good cause. We could be those people. A cluster of blank faces stare back at Dawn. They don't get it, not yet. They've had too many years of no and can't and move the hell on, you're not allowed to sleep here. We have 4 months, Dawn carries on. If we do it in shifts, we can use all of that time to raise money for St Jude's.
Well, that sets it up very nicely. And I just wonder, when you were working in this area, how close were you to writing a book? Was it in your mind at all?
Oh, not at all. I used to joke sometimes with the other staff that it would make a great TV show or a great book just because it's such a fascinating place to work. But I never actually thought I would write. That was something I did quite a bit later on.
Right. And the people you met in the hostel, is it possible without breaking any confidentiality regulations to tell us how some of them had ended up there?
Oh, there's always a story. Very often there's some really sad stories of abuse. Many people have had really difficult childhoods, but sometimes it's just people just having damn bad luck. Sometimes it's just someone's business had gone under, their marriage had broken up, a relationship had gone wrong, or they were fleeing violence. They were really worse, all sorts of, there's a whole spectrum of problems. But a lot of it does come from sort of a lack of support. So some people didn't have like good family support around them. Not all the time.
No, and I know you said you want to be positive.
Yeah.
The hostel played a part in allowing these individuals to change their lives for the better.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was wonderful to see. It doesn't always happen. People don't always get their happy ending like some of the residents do in the book, but there are so many people that do. And it just shows how important our homeless hostels are. They're not just a they are an absolute lifeline. They help people with a myriad of other things as well. So getting back to work, accessing training, sometimes reconnecting with family as well, if something's gone wrong that can be fixed. They're all things that can contribute to people's lives being turned around. So that's why it's so important that we get better funding in our hostels, because some are closing down, and ones that aren't closing down are losing staff because of funding cuts, or they're losing resources as well. And I think it's a time where we're going to need homeless services more than ever as a result of what's happening at the moment.
Yeah, so many people obviously up against it in all sorts of ways right now. Yeah. I know that your own personal situation is not that usual, because you are writing, you've now got a two-book deal, which is brilliant, but you're also a carer.
Yes.
And that is also the subject of your next book. So tell me a little bit about that.
Okay, so it wasn't originally about caring, it just became about caring because it's a big part of my life. So I was actually working as a midwife, and I gave that up for a while because my husband's very unwell. He has mental health issues, so I'm a carer on and off for him. When you care for someone with mental health issues, it's quite sort of a transient thing, so somebody can be quite well one week and then another week need a lot more support, which has been a challenge. But I think during lockdown, all carers, the things that they're dealing with anyway have just been that much more magnified. So carers are often quite isolated as it is, because it's not that easy to just get up and go out sort of at the drop of a hat all the time. Carers don't have access to the support network that they normally would have. So there's a lot of carers groups that people go to, or they're not able to go out and see their friends and family and sort of unload and have their needs kind of met.
Yes.
If you know what I mean.
It's really important, isn't it, that books are written by people like you with a rich and varied working life experience. I mean, I don't mean to criticise people who go to a great university and then write a book, but that's one set of circumstances, isn't it? You've got a lot to draw on in your own life.
Yeah, I found that really helpful, actually. I did write a practice novel before I ever wrote Dawn Brightside, and I think that was just a sort of a story, really, and it didn't connect. It only started connecting when I started writing what I know, and it's nice to be able to write something that you feel quite passionately about and you want to get a message out that could help other people as well, that could be in the same situation.
Is that good advice then? I mean, I'd love to know, do you think your practice novel will ever see the light of day?
No, definitely not.
Why not? What's wrong with it?
What's right with it? No, it was. I enjoyed doing it. That's where I learned. I made a lot of mistakes, but that's where I learned how to write, because I think you learn how to write just by writing sometimes. I have recycled some things, so the setting, I love the setting that I did in my practice novel, and that's been recycled for book two, which is out next November.
Right, okay.
So nothing's wasted.
No, well, that's, I think that's extremely good advice. I mean, it's just, you have to, in the end, sit down and do it, don't you? There is no...
Yeah, absolutely.
There's no alternative to that. That's the novelist Jessica Rinn, whose first book is out now, and it's called The Extraordinary Hope of Dawn Brightside. And I'm looking forward as well to reading her next one about being a carer, because that, again, is not always a subject that's addressed by novelists. So it'll be interesting to have a look at that when it comes out late next year. Now, to your thoughts on the programme today. Loads of good stuff from you. Thank you. This listener says, as a bulimia sufferer for the past 20 years, having developed the condition while being treated for anorexia, I was pretty desensitised watching the portrayal of Diana in The Crown. My husband and I discussed it after watching, since I only recently started opening up and being more honest about what is a very difficult illness to hide. I'm curious if you've heard from many other sufferers and whether Woman's Hour would perhaps open up the discussion to bring to the forefront a topic, while incredibly shameful for many people, it's this silence that feeds shame, and that perpetuates a terrible cycle. Like Diana, I'm actually underweight, and the misconception that sufferers of bulimia tend to be overweight is again a misnomer through misinformation. Well, to that listener, it is a subject we have addressed, I think, actually in the recent past. So if you were to go to a search engine and have a look for bulimia and Woman's Hour, you will find a conversation on the subject. I'm pretty sure we did certainly within the last year. Although I don't know about you, I have found that during the course of lockdown, my memory about what happened and when it happened, it's all getting very hazy. But I know we have done it. Susan says, I've refused to watch this from the beginning as it's inevitable, as it's a drama, and there'll be exaggeration and fiction, and it's cruel and unfair on the characters who are alive or dead, but cared about by the present family. This latest series sounds worst of all, as I predicted when I heard about it. Think about the two princes, for goodness sake, let alone Prince Charles and the Queen. On your programme, you said people should realise it's exaggerated in many ways and should be viewed with that in mind. But the people who are most likely to take it as fact are not listening to your programme. Yes, that may be true, although you'd be surprised by who listens to Woman's Hour. All sorts of people. Paul says, I think it's ethically wrong to claim something as fiction when you're writing living people in factual situations. If you're going to make up relationships and dialogue, do it as The West Wing did about a presidency, or Succession has done about a media family, which is similar to the Murdochs, but is clearly fictional. Andrea says, interesting to hear this discussion just now, and yes, it was a valid point that Diana was only 19, but didn't her own family query what she was doing? Surely older and caring siblings would have sat her down and had a conversation about what marriage to the Prince of Wales would involve. Or were they all blinded by the glory of having the future queen as part of their family? Well, that's an interesting point. Of course, Diana had two older sisters and a younger brother. So and certainly they'd grown up, I think, around the royal family. So they did know. That's a reasonable point. On to the subject of students. Sharon says, what about those students who quite reasonably decided that going to campus was a silly idea when all their teaching is online but still have to pay their rent or hall fees? My son's paid £2,500 for his university room and spent two nights in it. Yes, I'm glad that you made that point about the cost. My daughter is at university, so I am sort of aware of the cost of accommodation. It's astounding when you think about it. It's a lot of money for a room that, let's be honest, in some cases, and obviously I'm a doting mother and I want my little princess to be in comfort, but in some cases wasn't brilliant. I have to say, she's in her third year now, so she's not in that situation. But I do feel for anyone worried about their first year child right now. However, here's a more positive note from Helen. My son went to York University at the end of September. We live in Somerset, so he hasn't been home and we haven't seen him since then. We're so excited about our reunion on the 9th. I've got everything crossed that he's not delayed by a positive test. His university has been really organised and have communicated with students so they all know what's happening. I just want people to know that his experience has been so much better than you're representing. I know of many have had a difficult time, but my son has been so lucky to live with 11 others in his bubble and they've all supported each other. They have not had to self-isolate, nor have they had COVID. He has really enjoyed being away from home. Getting to know a manageable number of people has really suited him, and he's enjoyed cooking for himself, and I quietly feel a real sense of pride for having prepared him. That's good. That's a more positive note. Glad about that. From Debbie, as a parent of a first-year student, I'd like to say that although it has been difficult, they did go willingly and in the full knowledge of the possible disruption they'd experience. My daughter's had online lectures and face-to-face ones. She had suspected COVID earlier in the term, which meant that she had to isolate in her room, and her flatmates were quarantined in the flat. They coped amazingly. Five girls who were still in the very early stages of getting to know each other, and they pulled together. If anything, this has made their friendship stronger. Well, that's good to know as well. And I think I did say earlier in all this that some fantastic friendships will have been forged during these months at university. I suspect lifelong connections will have been made. And that's fantastic. And perhaps we ought to celebrate the support that many students have been able to provide for each other. From Nick, read your interview with Michelle Donnellan. My son is now in his fourth year of studying chemistry at Durham University. Most of his work this year should have been a practical research project in the labs, but he's had no lab time and, as things stand, is unlikely to get any until the spring. I understand that COVID's had a huge impact for us all, but endless online teaching is not an adequate substitute. Yet the university's minister still believes that it's right that he should pay the full tuition fees. I'm sorry, I don't normally write to programmes, says Emma, But this woman, Michelle Donnellan, is talking nonsense. I've got children at university in the Northeast, and they're not getting any live education. It is all online. The support for them is dire. Yes, they have all had COVID. Something has got to be done to compensate them for this ghastly experience. Okay, so many here. From Jane, my son is a third-year student, lives in a house with three others who've been exemplary in isolating throughout all this. The university is aiming to test all students in a very short period of time. He's reluctant to go out and mix with others in order to get the test when the queues may cause him to catch COVID. Yeah, I get that. I suppose that's your thought as well. And I just want to acknowledge the many, we've had emails from lecturers saying they're doing their best. And here's an email too from somebody who works in student wellbeing. I'd be grateful if you didn't use my name, or don't worry about that. Our whole team are working so very hard in normal times. With the current situation, we're under incredible pressure, but we keep going because we really do care and we realise how important our service is. Right, many of you wanted to talk about the age at which your mother died and how it affected you. My lovely mum died suddenly with a brain aneurysm in 1963 when I was just 14, and it was the most horrendous day of my life, and I've never got over it. I should say I'm 72 now. There's been a huge gap in my whole life, and I've always felt very abnormal when I was a child, as I was the odd one out with no mum. My father was an alcoholic, and my sister and I looked after ourselves during our teenage years. I felt for years and years an outsider. The thing I've missed most is just being able to be hugged and to hug my mum. I'm so sorry to hear that. That's obviously the death of a much-loved parent that's had a lifelong impact. Angela says, I'm not sure I will ever make the age my mother dies at, as she's 94 next month. It's lovely that she's still with us, but so hard in COVID times not to be able to see her and give her a hug, especially knowing that she might not be here for much longer. From Angela, this was so real for me. My mum died just after my 21st. At my 18th, she said to me, we'll have a proper party when you're 21. So really, of course, there was no celebration. Nothing but misery, which I've never been able to get over. It was such a shock. From Sue, I was 47 when my mum died suddenly. It was instant role reversal. At that moment, I had to look after my dad, who was just 72. I had to deal with his grief. I hardly had time for my own. And from Tricia, both my mother and grandmother died at 69. I'm 69 next year. Yes, I do joke about it, but I'm anxious. Honestly, I could carry on reading so many of these, and I just want to end with this one, which just made me smile a little bit. I was listening this morning. I lost my mother when I was 17, and she was in her early 50s. I was convinced that she'd been 53. As I approached that age, I was very concerned. We were abroad for a long time. We came home and I went to my mother's grave and found out that actually she'd been 51 and I was already 52. I sat down on her grave and I had a laugh. And honestly, I felt I could hear her laughing too. That's lovely. Thank you for that. That's from Margaret. We're back in radio and podcast form with the Best of Our Woman's Hour week. And then, of course, we're back live 10:02 Monday morning. Thank you for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So, how do we get AI right?
Well, we need the right volume of data, the software to train it, and massive compute power, or...
Another one bites the dust. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat?
But with HPE GreenLake, we get access to supercomputing to power AI at the scale we need, helping generate better insights.
All right.
Nice teamwork, guys.
Search HPE GreenLake.